34 years ago, in 1956, three important lectures were given at Attingham Park for the Shropshire Adult College. On February 26th, December 1st, and December 2nd. Since the lecture on December 2nd was very important, I chose December 2nd, the anniversary, for today's meaning to restart our groups. The following year, on May 24th, a very important lecture for the Plotinus Society was given at Somerville College, Oxford University. Now, the lectures at Attingham Park were given, and I was invited to give a talk on the subject of Christian culture. Can it be something for all the world? That was on the 26th of February, 1956. The rise of Christian culture was dealt with in part one, and why it could not be for all the world was dealt with in part two. I asked special leave from the organizers to divide the lecture into two parts, 45 minutes before morning coffee and 45 minutes after morning coffee. It was somewhat amusing to hear the conversation that went along whilst we were having coffee. Of course, he's going to support the idea of Christian culture for all the world. But I'm afraid they were disappointed in the matter, in part two, as regards all the world. But they were mostly university people, and they quite understood why I presented the subject in that way, and showed and presented all the reasons why any one culture cannot be a world culture. Too many factors are at play to prevent that. As a result of that lecture, I was invited again to speak at a seminar whose subject was The Scientist and the Seer. The Holy One. Now, on this occasion, I gave two separate lectures, each 90 minutes, divided by coffee on each occasion. The first talk was titled Discord by me, and the second one was titled Harmony. The essence of the talk on discord you will find in chapter 5 of my last book, Holistic Consciousness. And that chapter 5 is titled Reason versus Revelation. It also traces the rise of science from very ancient times up to modern times, and also shows how in modern times, in our own century, this 20th century, many of the so-called beliefs and experimentally proved facts have been shown not to hold good. That too I have mentioned in chapter 5. And the lecture on harmony is split up between chapters 7 and 8 of Holistic Consciousness. As for the lecture in the following year at Somerville College on the silence, you will find the essence of it in my book, Early Indian Religious Thought. That's the very first book that was published. Pages 318 to 323. And also in The Heart of Religion, the second book, from pages 337 to 360. I think it is necessary to say a few words on the silence so that you will see the significance and the implications and the importance of silence. In the ordinary way, we are conscious of everything and everybody throughout the universe as being finite and temporal. That means something comes into being, a creature is born, that something has its lifespan, that person has his lifespan, and then there is the ending, death. So we are conscious of everything whatsoever there is in terms of finitude and temporality. In other words, the Lord of death is Lord of all manifestation. Note carefully, of all manifestation. Now it is possible for human beings so to live and so to develop themselves that consciousness undergoes a transformation from stage to stage. And there comes the time when all finitude is transformed. Eternity takes its place. But how? Notice how we observe and how we, as we call it, think. We observe everything as a separate thing. That wall, for instance, is that wall. Each one of us is just each one of us. But we are unconscious of the very intimate relationship between that wall and ourselves. It is that relationship which makes a difference. It is the brain which continually talks. It is the instrument by which we recognize everything as being separate and different from us. Whereas the fact is that nothing is separate and different from us. There is a complete interrelationship and interaction between each and everything and each and every person in the universe. But we have to wake up to that. Now, religion is something which is concerned with that process of awakening and transcending the limitations imposed upon us by the brain and by speech. Thought and speech are the separators. We human beings are still at that stage. But there have been and there are a few human beings now living now in the world who are capable of transcending those limitations. And the result is that consciousness, instead of being limited to the finite and the temporal, and therefore be under the lordship of death, they can be conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. Which means that the ordinary human consciousness, which is subject to death, is no longer subject to death, but realizes immortality in the real sense, here and now. And when that happens, the brain stops talking. If you watch your thought process, your thinking process, your living process, you will find that the brain is constantly chattering away, mainly round oneself. You will be surprised to discover how many thousand times in a few minutes the word I will crop up. It is only in dreamless slumber that the brain also goes to sleep and stops chattering. Then, although that is an opportunity for you to be conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal, we cannot bring that back into ordinary waking consciousness because of the limitations imposed by the brain. Now, when the brain stops talking, there is silence in the real sense. You know how in the school of Pythagoras, the neophytes were taught for the first 2 years to maintain complete silence of the tongue, stop talking. How many thousand times does a school teacher shout at his class, "Stop talking"? He little realizes that he is uttering a truth which is so great that it is completely beyond his class. When the brain stops talking, consciousness is utterly free of all the limitations the brain imposes upon our observation and upon our knowledge. So the silence is the state of complete liberation, the state where you are at one with the universe and at one with that from which the origin, from which the universe emerges. The universe as a whole is only a manifestation of that origin, whatever it may be. It is that origin is something which cannot be thought about, which cannot be described, which cannot be observed by the senses. But it can be consciously experienced when there is complete perfection of the organism, of the body-mind. I shouldn't use the word mind, but I should say body and psyche. Mind is something which we do not possess. Mind is the activity, the formative activity of that transcendent origin which gives rise to all manifestation. That is what mind is. We have, when mind interacts with body, with manifestation, it gives rise to psyche. I know that in the great religions and philosophies, people have always talked about the psyche as mind. But that, and as a matter of fact, at the beginning of our century, a scientist said that the brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile. Now this, people will come to realize, particularly in the next century, I trust, is hopelessly limited. So, what we have to, we are psychophysical organisms. And when that organism undergoes complete purification, then it is possible for that organism to experience this transcendent consciousness whilst the body, the physical body, is still alive. All the founders of the great religions, all the truly religious people who were the true spiritual teachers of the world for, well, at least 5 or 6 millennia now. And they were people who had realized this type of consciousness. I have chosen to call it holistic consciousness because it is a consciousness that is completely and totally inclusive of everything. There is nothing excluded from that consciousness. But do not think, therefore, that the Holy One, the perfected Holy One, as the Buddha used to call him, is somebody who is a walking encyclopedia. Not at all. He would probably not be able to get through a GCSE paper if it is said to him, because all these intellectual attainments and developments that we have here in our world are only in the sphere of limitation and therefore not the transcendent reality. Now, it is a mistake to regard religion and religious living as excluding everything of in secular living. Most people feel and believe that to be religious means to be solemn, to be miserable in fact, and so forth. Now, nothing could be further from the truth. It is the supreme means of realizing the ultimate supreme happiness. Our concept of happiness is sensational excitement and so forth. But we have our natural interests and our abilities. We talk in terms of a God-given gift. We say that Mozart had the God-given gift to compose as he did compose when he was only a tiny tot, and so forth. And there are many such people. Of course, this is not the end point, but it is part of the process. Now, in our groups, which we have had for the last 28 years, 1962 to 1988, when we stopped. And I took a long holiday, and I'm starting again, with some considerable difficulty, as you see, because it isn't easy to give up that sort of work for 2 years, 3 years now. It'll be in April, coming April, and restart again. I think some of you know that I studied the piano for 8 1/4 years under Solomon. I have given a few recitals during my lifetime in this country, particularly during the war years for war charities, and also in India, and started the fashion there in India for Indians to study Western music, give recitals, and so on. Now, sometimes Solomon and I used to talk about deep things. He was not a practicing Jew in the true sense of the word. For him, music was religion and the whole of religion. And those who have had the privilege of knowing him and the way he played a piano know only too well that when he played, it was something transcendental. He was able to say through his piano playing what great geniuses have not been able to formulate. Now, religion in that sense is not confined only to arts, science, and philosophy. You will also find it in the realm of sport. For Pelé and Maradona, have I pronounced his name correctly? Football is religion. That is why they play so wonderfully. Ian Botham for cricket. Navratilova and Bjorn Borg for tennis. Steve Davis for snooker. And now he's being succeeded by Stephen Henry. In my home, my first home in Colombo, where I spent the first 18 years of my life and had my ordinary school education, we had a cook. His name was Solamuthu. Solamuthu. He was a South Indian Tamil, but he was a genius of a cook, and he really treated his cooking as if it was religion. He always used to bow before the fire. We had just the ordinary wood fire for cooking. And he would utter some prayers in Hindu. Being a Tamil, he was a Hindu. And also, we had a rickshaw coolie. You know, they still have rickshaws in Sri Lanka, now named Sri Lanka. And his name was Pasun. Pasun had a really religious feeling about his pulling a rickshaw. He could easily overtake anybody and everybody pulling a rickshaw. And he was completely devoted to my father, whom he served, for so many years. When my father was very ill with enteric fever, almost dying, but he didn't die, he lived many years afterwards. So Basun turned round upon me and said, I would give up my life to run fast and fetch the doctor and save your father's life. He had that religious feeling about his rickshaw pulling. I am giving just two such examples. Here in our groups, we have people interested in various subjects. For instance, I hope you will forgive me for mentioning names, Eileen Benson and Liz David for astrology, Anne Betty, she's not here, is she? Anne Betty is not here. For the Alexander technique, Lila DeLise for Tai Chi. Mary Steele, Anne Green, Bob and Renate Lee, and where's the other Bob? Butt, John Butt. John Butt for yoga. For homeopathy, we have Lisa Monk. She's not present. Unfortunately, she couldn't come because she's so very busy. And she's remarkably successful with her work. An original thinker and worker. And we have today, I'm very glad to welcome Suzanne Deuter, who is also a homeopath. We have Suzanne Dennis and Pamela Laurie for gardening, house repairing and decorating, etc. We have Michael Jenkinson, who is not present, for nursing. He's at the hospital at the moment. And he is willing to do some work with a group for those who may be interested in learning the elements of nursing. We have Martha Aitchison, Jackie Grice, both of whom are not here today, and Pat Thurston for painting. And several members, I think the majority of people here, for cooking. I could name some excellent cooks in this room, but they would feel too shy, I think, if I named them, so I won't name them. I spoke to Beryl Jenks, who is not here today, because she's far too ill now. For drama and elocution. She's an expert at that. Sylvia Swain, who is not here, on Jungian psychology. She really knows her stuff. I've heard many talks from her. Juanita Nalaro for ceramics, and there are those who are very keen on photography. So you see, there's plenty of talent in different members of the group, and I trust that those whom I have not mentioned will come to hear of this and also come forward to form little groups. Those who came in previous years remember that all this space here was occupied by the Steinway Grand. Now that is gone to my grandson, because he's the real musician of the family, not I. And I think I thought wisely, because recently I haven't touched the piano at all. For months and months I haven't touched it. And there was no point in waiting till I die before the piano went to him. So now it's gone to him. It's better that it be used than just remain as a piece of furniture. I must come now to a very important point. Everyone, be it a newborn babe or an old man longing for serenity, seeks happiness. Everybody seeks happiness in some form or other. Great teachers were concerned with man's well-being and happiness. The Buddha, for instance, as he himself declared, "One thing and one thing alone I teach, suffering, the suffering which takes place in the world, and the ending of that suffering." And Krishnamurti in our century had the same outlook and view, and did and worked along those lines. Every parent is concerned for the happiness of his children, and every good friend is concerned for the happiness and well-being of his friend. Now, there is a very interesting discourse, one of the middle-length discourses, number 59 in the Majjhima Nikaya, as it is called. And it is called the Bahu Vedaniya Sutta. Bahu means much, Vedaniya to be experienced, Sutta. And this sutta deals with the question, sutta is discourse, you see, deals with the question of happiness. The Buddha starts with happiness which is obtained through the senses, through what we see, hear, touch, taste, smell. And he says, there are those who declare that this happiness is the supreme happiness. And he goes on to tell his great disciple Ananda, who was his personal attendant, that he does not hold with that view. And then he describes the different states of consciousness which one may enter into, the jhanas, as they are called. Sometimes they have been translated as raptures by scholars, particularly Western scholars. I would prefer to use the word peace, different states of peace. And the first jhana, which is the Pali word, jhana is the same as dhyana, attention, paying attention. Your attention is directed along the lines of initial thought and discursive thought, concentrating the brain upon any subject. All the Buddhist translations, and I think the Buddha himself, used the word mind. I think it is more correct to use the word psyche and brain. The word mind is so muddled up with the brain. I think I'll repeat what I said a little earlier. The formative power of the primordial creative energy, which itself is shapeless and formless, by its activity brings into being shape and form, all of manifestation. Now that is mind. That is the divine mind, the mind of God, if you like, or Brahman, or use any word you please. So, the first jhana produces a state of happiness, of well-being, of peace, which is ineffable as compared with the peace which you obtain through all sense activities. Mind you, some sense activities somehow call up this transcendent state. I remember very well when I was writing, particularly when I was writing my first two books, there were times when the ideas as they came used to bring tears to my eyes. I was very much moved by the state of consciousness which prevailed. Now, when a great composer, Bach or Beethoven or Mozart or somebody like that, gets a brilliant inspiration, he also experiences something of this transcendent state. He's in a jhana, and he puts down what comes through his jhana. Then the Buddha goes on to say that by the subsiding of initial thought and discursive thought, particularly discursive thought, one enters the second stage, which is even more transcendent, more happy. It's peculiar to talk in terms of more transcendent, because you have no measuring stick for these things. But it is a deeper state. What happens is that the intensity of the peace which prevails throughout your whole being becomes greater. It is more intense. And then he says that the third jhana is even more intense than the second. And then the fourth. And then comes a turning point. With the fourth jhana, there is a going down, a complete ending, so to say, of all sense perception and sense experience. With that going down, one enters into the truly transcendent states of consciousness. And the first one, I shall have to use the Sanskrit word, is the stage of infinite akasha. Akasha is primordial material, the primordial substance, that which stands under, which was the material for the primordial creative energy to produce a universe. And in this state, various psychical faculties are associated. I won't try to speak about them now because it would take too long. Then the next one is the infinity of discriminative consciousness. Now, I mentioned earlier about that wall and myself, and that ordinarily I am unconscious of the relationship, the complete unifying and united relationship with the wall or with anything and everything that is in the universe. You see? Now, in that infinity of consciousness, as it is called, infinity of discriminative consciousness, you have transcended the limitations of discrimination. That is to say, of separation, of not being able to be aware in terms of being that which you are observing. You become a wall. You become an apple when you are eating an apple, and so on. It's an extraordinary experience, I can assure you of that. But that is as far as I can assure you. And in this state, there is the first entry into the consciousness of eternity. So many mystics who have written about this have talked of eternity, have identified it with timelessness. You experience timelessness in dreamless slumber, but that is not eternity, because and if you practice systems of meditation, they can lead you up to the experience of timelessness. But that is not eternity, because the organism enters that state at a certain point in time, and it has to come out of that state at another point in time, otherwise the organism will die. British officers in India who have been shown yogis under the tree meditating like this, and some who are dead because they didn't enter out of this state of consciousness. The Buddha speaks, when he speaks of himself, he says that he enters that state for 7 days and 7 nights only, continuously, and then comes out of that state. Because the organism has to be fed, it has to breathe, it has to exercise, it has to sleep, it has to eliminate, and so on. You see? These are the limitations imposed upon us by the fact that we are human organisms. And then there is that stage where there is neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. And the final stage is the cessation of all even of transcendent perception and feeling. Because in these deep states, which are called the samapattis, and in the dictionary you will find the word attainment or achievement given for samapatti. I think that's a mistake. A samapatti is an actual personal realization. It is not an attainment or an achievement. It is so difficult to talk about these things. That is transcended finally, and there's the complete cessation of even the transcendent perception and feeling. There are those mystics who have written about the communicating with God, talking with God, listening to God, and so on and so on. That stage is also transcended, and there is that stage which Christian mystics have spoken of as reduced to one's nothingness. But that nothingness is not an absolute vacuousness, an absolute vacuity. It is the profounder stage that the human organism can possibly experience. You know how they say that Christ went up into the Mount of Olives to pray. And it is this kind of prayer that is realized in these states. Now, with sense pleasures, you experience ecstasy with this happiness of the mind, the inner mind itself within you, in consciousness. You experience ecstasy. Ecstasy is a being beside yourself, out of control of yourself. Ecstasy is a going within. You may remember the Buddha said, look within, thou art Buddha, thou art the enlightened one. And it is a state of enlightenment, of freedom, and of ineffable peace. It is the supreme bliss that the human organism can ever know. And it is And this unio mystica with the teacher, with a Christ, with a Buddha, Krishna, which spells supreme freedom, for it takes place in complete selflessness. That is the happy Christmas I wish you all.